Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we're now in our fall pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the donate button. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. If you donate now through October 31st, your contribution will be matched dollar per dollar up to $4,500. Once again, thanks for supporting KBOO. A couple weeks ago, I had the wonderful opportunity to chat with Northwest environmental writer, poet, novelist, and butterfly expert Robert Michael Pyle about his new book, Nature Matrix. We had a freewheeling conversation sitting on the front porch of my friend Susan Banyas' house in Astoria, overlooking the Columbia River and the hills beyond. You can hear the sounds of Astoria in the background. Bob, welcome to Locus Focus.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. What fun to be back at KBOO, which is a dear old heartmate of mine.
We're actually sitting on my friend Susan Banyas' front porch in Astoria, and we're doing this interview face-to-face, which is a real pleasure during this time of pandemic. So it's nice to actually see you, Bob.
It's a total pleasure, Barbara. And Susan, thank you, to be with real people and not Zooming. Looking out over the Columbia, just a few blocks from us, and the marine layer trying to come up the river, but the sun pushing it back. It's all real things.
Well, I wanted to start out actually by telling you a story. And this was a memory that was inspired by many of the essays in your book, Nature Matrix, that talk about the importance of children being able to connect with nature throughout their childhood and the importance of these small places that are natural, that are close to where children live. A number of years ago, my wife and I were hiking in Forest Park in Portland, and these two kids came barreling towards us down the trail. We were on the Wildwood Trail right by Balch Creek. And it looked like a bigger brother was chasing his little brother. And the little brother, as he runs past us, says, "I feel like I'm in a video game."
I'm not sure quite what to think about that, you know, aspiring toward a video game when they're out. But at least they were out. That brings to mind a time for me when I was in Utah teaching at Utah State. And I had to go into a Target to pick up a fry pan or something. And I went through the electronics section to get to the kitchen section. There were a number of boys on the video games. And one of them was playing with great gusto a game of mountain biking in the forest. And I thought, well, he could be sort of out doing that. We're right here in the Wasatch. But at least he's concentrating on the outdoors. I thought that was kind of cool until I realized that the object of the game was to knock over the other hikers and the old people on the trail and the animals and crash into as many as you could.
We make a lot of references in your essays about the problem you have with so many young people's only connection to nature is actually on a screen, that they aren't getting out in nature anymore. And I wonder when you started noticing that as a shift in the way that children relate, because I mean, our generation, we spent a lot of time playing outside. Even kids I know who grew up in New York, at least they'd go to Central Park or Riverside Park. So what do you think has made it so enticing for kids these days to spend time in front of screens instead of spending time in real life?
Darn good question, Barbara. It's partly enticement, but it's partly being driven to it. I grew up in Denver, east of Denver, on farmed out plains near Aurora. And my escape into the rest of the natural world was the Highline Canal, an old ditch that took water from the Rockies out onto the plains. My tract subdivision, one of the first post-war developments of that sort, east of Denver, was happily situated just a mile from this canal. My brother discovered it and came back and said, "Come on, Bobby, there's a ditch, it's cool. Let's go," and I did, and we went there for the next many years. And that became the subject of my book called The Thunder Tree, Lessons from an Urban Wildland, which is all about the connection of kids with their special places. We had low adventure almost every day of our childhoods out there, certainly every summer day. Well, I began to notice that the habitats where we were able to be free-range kids were vanishing before my eyes. My field where I sought the Olympia marble-wing butterflies became my own track and field when I was entering a new school right by the ditch. My colony of bronze copper butterflies was extirpated when the Lutherans paved their parking lot, which was an old marsh. And I started seeing that happening, and that became the basis of my my concept that I called the extinction of experience, which I re-explore in Nature Matrix. But the idea that when common things become rare or absent in our immediate environs, what I call our radius of reach, then we become further inured from nature, further alienated. That brings about greater apathy. And with apathy comes an absence of activism, and therefore the losses increase, and it becomes a truly vicious circle. And the extinction of experience is very powerful, and it works hand in glove with what Richard Louv called nature deficit disorder in his brilliant book, The Last Child in the Woods. Rich took a lot of his inspiration, I'm happy to say, from the Thunder Tree, but both of us had noted similar time in our lives that the kinds of places where we went, where you went, where we were able to go, were disappearing. So that's number one, is the loss of the actual humble places close to our homes. They don't have to be wilderness. They don't have to be a forest preserve. They can be a vacant lot, and they often are a vacant lot, because to a curious child, what's less vacant than a vacant lot? What's less wasted than waste ground? So that's the first thing, is the disappearance of those places. The second thing is the rise of stranger danger fear among people. The actual incidents of abduction and violence toward children out of doors hasn't increased. In fact, by some measures, it's thought to have decreased. However, the awareness of it and the publicity of it have grown to epidemic proportions, where people are terribly afraid to have their children out of doors. And if they do so, if they allow them to be free range in their neighborhood, they're likely to be head up for child abuse. I mean, I talk to groups of people and I say, how many of you can think of what was a special place to you that made the world real to you? And most hands go up. You know, a ditch, a creek, a rock, a tree, grandma's back 40, our backyard, whatever. If they're lucky, a river and a mountain. Those places they remember. How many of you can still go to that place and have it largely the same? Not so many hands go up, not nearly as many. But then I ask, how many of you had what I call the freedom of the day to wander as children? Most hands go up, men's and women's. And this is the thing, it's not only become rare. Then I say, how many of you allow your children that freedom? How many of you have grandchildren who have the freedom of the day? Almost no hands go up. And if they do, it's going to be boys. So it's gone from being a non-gendered thing to being deeply gendered. When I was a boy, the girls also had the freedom to wander. And I think that was true in many cities as well as in the suburbs and the countryside. Then you take the hard wiring at the navel to an electronic USB port that kids all come up with now. And they're great expertise at it, which, let's face it, it's been a real boon to children to have the expertise with the electronics now that they can't go to school. It's a sad way to go to school, but at least they know how to do it. So there is that. But that's where the enticement begins to come in. The seductive nature of video games, the rapid reinforcement. Becoming acquainted with something real in the world takes a little bit of a willingness to have deferred gratification. You know, playing games, making up your own stories. You've got to be able to picture and imagine and have the reward down the line. But with games, it's like pinball machines before them. You got the bing, 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 bing. You know, you had to have your reward constantly and right now. But that enticement goes along with the loss of the places and the loss of the freedom on the part of children.
Well, are you familiar with the movie The Blair Witch Project?
Yes, I am.
I had this feeling when I saw it. I thought it was one of the most boring movies I ever saw, and I couldn't wait till they died so I could go home. But I got very concerned, actually, about how younger people were finding it really, really scary. And I was thinking, it's like, you know, a quarter acre woods in suburban Maryland. This is not the wilderness. And it made me think, this is an indication of how this next generation, that's probably two generations younger than me, has been growing up without any sense at all of the woods. And I, who grew up in a little industrial city in central New England, I had a little patch of woods a block from the house where I spent a lot of time growing up. So I wonder, if you have any thoughts when you saw that movie about maybe this is an indicator of something really going amok with young people.
Yes, for me, I think there was a shift of emphasis from necessarily being a place of intrigue to being a place of mortal fear. I think it's wonderful that a quarter acre patch of woods behind the subdivision can engender imagination, can engender wonder. And yeah, a little bit of spookiness and risk because it's outside the manicured yard. Now that's a fine thing, that kids can transfer their wonder from a big wilderness to a small patch of woods. But to make it into a place of horror, as opposed to sort of what's going to happen next and what are we going to find today? It could be good, you know. And how are we going to play? Sure, some of the games we played out on the Highline Canal were monster-oriented and scary-oriented, especially at night. But it wasn't a matter of the place engendering evil, you know. And the fact that this little patch of woods was inherently evil, that bothered me as much as anything. I'm thrilled that kids can still find bewitchment in the wild, even if the wild is, as I say, a little vacant lot, or a patch of ground underneath an ivy hedge, you know, wherever it is. But to transfer that from a place of investigation and discovery and aha into a place of shattering fear, that seems to me malevolent.
Well, it also makes me worried about these kids having an ability to actually go out into the woods. If you grow up with a fear of nature, what does that leave you with? And how can you connect to the larger world besides what's human-made?
That's certainly true. And I've been to a number of outdoor schools and outdoor education projects. I was did some graduate study in a field called nature interpretation, where you take people into the woods and you give them some tools to see a little more deeply through their own curiosity, not really educating or passing information so much as invoking curiosity. If the intervention by the teacher, the adult, is too supervisory, too obtrusive, then the imagination on the part of the child suffers. But on the other hand, if the place seems so foreign that they would need to have an ambassador of some kind to keep them safe out there, that's even sadder. Yes, will they have any woodcraft at all? Will they have any ability to tell one organism from another? There was a time from about the 1890s to about the 1930s when the American nature study movement was vigorous. A woman named Anna Botsford Comstock ran it out of Cornell, and she published pamphlets for teachers and kids all over the country that were published in a big book called The Nature Study Handbook. It's still in print. Great big wonderful thing. And she said in the introduction, in 1911 edition, there's nothing in this book that an ordinary boy of 12, notice she said boy, but she really meant child, would not know from their ordinary time out of doors. Well, that's certainly not the case now. But even so, she was thinking that, and the project was oriented toward keeping kids, you can't keep them down on the farm if they're going to go to the city, but you might be able to maintain their interest and a little bit of knowledge of the countryside. So the nature study movement came about, and it was considered, Barbara, an ordinary thing that local flora and fauna would be an element of basic elementary education, along with reading, writing, arithmetic. But after World War I and gearing up for World War II, and particularly after Sputnik, Sputnik was the coup de grace of the nature study practice. It was already on the way out. With the rise of hard science and numerical science in the schools, that was a good thing. But not instead of nature study. It should have been alongside nature study. But once Sputnik came along and there was a fear of getting behind in the space race and the weapons race, that was really the end of natural history in the schools. And it was followed by the purge of the naturalists from the universities.
I'm just remembering when I was in second grade, which was the year before Sputnik, we had two science sections. In the first semester, it was astronomy, which totally hooked me, and I wanted to be an astronomer. And then the second section was about birds, and that's my other big passion. And then Sputnik happened in third grade, and I don't remember any more nature science that we studied. So that sort of just confirms what you're saying.
You're a living example. You're a living proof of my thesis.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Robert Michael Pyle, who's a Northwest environmental writer, poet, novelist, and butterfly expert. We're talking about the extinction of experience and his new book, Nature Matrix. I think it's kind of interesting that one of the better things that's been a result of the COVID pandemic is that people are outside more. And there's two sides to it. One just came to me this morning. I was looking at photographs. In the New York Times every morning on their website, they have photographs from around the world. And there was a classroom someplace in Massachusetts, I think, and the kids were sitting outside the school on stumps, and they were all like 8 feet apart. Do you think that that might be a good start of something new?
Well, it's not new, but it might be a real, forgive me, shot in the arm for the nature schooling movement, yes. Let's pick up where we lost nature study in the schools. And many years later, with the 60s and the eco this and the eco that, came environmental education. But it wasn't really until a number of us started writing about children and nature and the loss of that, that a real movement started called the Children and Nature Network, co-founded by Richard Louv, who wrote The Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Kids from Nature Deficit Disorder. And that's really become a big thing now. There are a lot of schools that are working with community gardens and designing for not just outdoor teaching, but outdoor teaching that involves some free play and some discovery, not entirely supervised. But now comes the germ, and I tell you, I was really kind of taken aback by what you mentioned, because in the first place I thought, oh great, here comes the apotheosis of the virtual. We've already been so deep in the artificial or the virtual taking over from real experience, enough to almost despair. But here comes something that's going to make people have to have what schooling they have in front of a screen. Even more time in front of a bloody screen. Not even recess. Not even walking to and from school, as if very many people did that anymore. And so I was thinking, wow, COVID's going to be just what we need now to certify the virtual world. And then I started seeing things such as you mentioned. Some people were talking about, well, we can safely meet outdoors if we're careful. Let's have some more outdoor schooling. And Richard Louv and I have talked about this. We both said, well, yeah, that's what we've been talking about anyway. So if this becomes a push, if this becomes a, and it has, becomes a reason, becomes a lever to get kids away from the screen, outdoors, to be doing some schooling where they should be doing it anyway, well, bravo. And another part of it is this that I hadn't figured on in the first place. I've heard more and more and more of kids who are getting sick of their screens. You know, they've always wanted more screen time, more social media time, more gaming time, more television time, and parents, trying to be responsible, try to monitor that, try to limit it, try to hold it back a little bit. And now, I mean, for the first time ever, I'm hearing kids say, I don't want to sit in front of the screen. I want to do something else. Can we go outdoors? And so I'm not quite applauding the germ, but I am saying lemonade from lemons in this case. This could be a good thing.
I have a neighbor who's, I guess he's 16, about to be 16, and he's an amazing birder. I go birding with him, and he knows so much about birds, and he leads bird walks in Oaks Bottom, which is the wetland in our neighborhood. And he's been trying to keep as active as possible doing birding and encouraging people to bird, even though he's not leading the bird walks anymore. But the other day, I walked by his house, and he was sitting on his front porch in front of his computer. Obviously, he was going to school. And it just pained me because he's one young man I know who really appreciates being outside.
Well, bravo for him, and I know a few kids like that. My old guy friends of mine and I, the men and the women who have worked on butterflies for many years, and we don't know how long we're going to be here. So who's going to pick it up? Who's going to keep the institutional collections? Who's going to keep the field guides updated? Who's going to keep butterfly studies going and other natural history? Well, I'm starting to see it's not such a worry, because out of the cracks are coming some young people who are really, really picking up on it and showing a lot of respect for the knowledge that's there in advance. Interestingly enough, a lot of the younger naturalists I meet who are very good at it, they often are people who might be said to have a learning disability or a focus quality about them that might make some of their traditional schooling and traditional social situations more challenging for them. But they have an intensely wonderful ability to hone in on detail and on the world around them. And they're doing so, and they're doing so in many cases through natural history. This is quite wonderful because, as Richard Louv has said, and others working with the Children in Nature Project, when nature schooling is brought into the classroom and the classroom brought out to it, oftentimes it becomes difficult to tell which students are the ones who are thought to need special attention. And I had this experience myself. I live across the Columbia River from where we're sitting in the tiny county of Wakayakum. And western Wakayakum County shares a school district with easternmost Pacific County. A few hundred kids. A few years ago, they had no special resources for what were called at the time special kids or for gifted kids, either one. So they would sometimes hire community members to come in and work with them. And I was hired on a freelance basis to do a little bit of outdoor schooling with both the special kids and the gifted kids. And sometimes they forgot to tell me which group I was taking out, and I couldn't tell. We'd get out and we'd be looking at fossils, we'd be looking at butterflies and beavers, and the curiosity would run rife. And I'd say, now wait a minute, am I supposed to be with the special kids or the gifted kids? And I love that. I love the fact that nature, the rest of nature, because we're part of nature, and I'm the last person to want to draw any kind of a line between people and the rest of nature. I think that's a very dangerous idea. That is a false dualism that I take to task in a big way in this book, Nature Matrix.
Well, why do you think it's so important for young people to turn into adults who are feeling connected to nature, besides just appreciating nature? We're living in the most dysfunctional period, I think, in American history. And a lot of it is this real split between nature and human beings. On the part of the current administration, I think, an effort to stomp out whatever is left of nature. How would young people growing up appreciating nature, how would that maybe help them to start to heal this kind of dichotomy?
You've got that exactly right, Barbara. And again, this is why I concentrate so much on it in this new book. Kids are not attracted to nature. They're attracted to everything. Therefore, they're attracted to nature. But you see, those are two different ways of looking at nature. You're absolutely right. The paradigm for centuries has been people and nature, as if they're different things. The reason I say that's one of the most dangerous ideas in the world is because it not only sets up the possibility of us living in a different reality from the other plants and animals, but it also licenses us for any number of enormities against the rest of nature. That's why I like the poet Patty Ann Rogers' term, the rest of nature, or the more than human nature. So I think that with children, they're very confused when they come into a world that more and more and more tries to make a distinction between the species they belong to and the other species around them to which they're attracted and by which they're fascinated. So if we can, through outdoor schooling, through the immersion, the direct immersion of kids with the rest of nature, as in the title of my essay in Nature Matrix, Eden in a Vacant Lot, Kids and Other Species in the Neighborhood of Life. You know, if we can get them to thinking of themselves as part of the whole show, as neighbors of the birds and the mammals, as cohabitants of the earth with the green things, then they're going to be far better adjusted. So yes, you get a so-called administration such as we're afflicted with now for another few weeks. And it's devastating how countervailing it is to the whole idea of oneness. I'm even distressed in the debates when the environment is reduced to climate change. I'm very glad climate change comes up. It's absolutely essential. It should be discussed. But in this election, in this whole news cycle, it's become almost equivalent with the environment. Little do we hear talk about biodiversity or about biocides or about population, certainly, or about the desertification, but about the many, many, many other forms of ecocide that we are committing. Whereas back in the 60s, in the elections in the 60s and the 70s, we heard about eco this and eco that. And even, it turns out, the Nixon administration was remarkably progressive in terms of environmental legislation and action. I'm not saying it was because Nixon himself wanted to do that, but people were actually aware that the rest of nature was under great threat. And something was done about it. Massive legislation that had a huge impact, such as the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts, the Wilderness Act, the Endangered Species Act. We forget it. Certainly was no environmental utopia, but it was progressive. We really thought we might get there, you know. Whereas for quite a while now, ever since Reagan, really, but coming to a head with the resident, he whose name I cannot bring myself to utter, it's actually so aggressively, pugnaciously against any sort of recognition. Trump was asked in the debate about climate change, and he said, "I want the purest air and the purest water." Well, fine, anybody can say that. Where you're considering the Pebble Mine and approving the tar sands and deracinating all of that legislation that we fought so hard for. Well, it doesn't need saying anymore. We all know these things. Children come along and see the hypocrisies. Children are extraordinarily aware of hypocrisy. If children can become aware of a crow cawing in the background or a jay sliding across the blue with its own blue, and that becomes part of their lives, well, then maybe there's a chance.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODI XLPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Robert Michael Pyle, Northwest environmental writer, poet, novelist, and butterfly expert. And we're talking about the extinction of experience and the way to maybe reunite young people with experience before it goes totally extinct. And we're also talking about his new book, Nature Matrix. You mentioned a while ago about this eco this and eco that, and that there's a lot more environmental studies happening. But you mentioned, I think it's in Nature Matrix, that some of that is kind of glossy, especially like let's call it ecotourism. I don't think you use that term in your book, but that's what I was thinking about, the way that people go and they imbibe nature and they imbibe natural sites. But it's very different from what I think that what you think is like a real connection with nature. And it was really epitomized in the story that you told about going to climb Beetle Rock. It reminded me of my own experience climbing Indian Rock in Berkeley, which I used to spend a lot of time on. I have friends who live around the corner from there, and I visited them all the time when I was working a lot down there. And every night I'd go watch the sunset there. This was back in the 80s. The last few times in the last 10 years that I've been up there, it's been a party scene. And in fact, I'd be sleeping or trying to sleep at night, and people on the weekend, the teenagers were drinking and playing music and shouting. So I thought about your experience with Beetle Rock. So let's talk a little bit about what happens when nature gets violated by, sometimes it's like love to death, is what the rangers are saying about Mount Hood these days. But I don't really think it's love to death. I think it's something else. What do you think that is?
Barbara, I think the answer to your question lies in the whole idea of intimacy with nature and how deeply we connect. Unless people are actually harming the land or the plants or the animals through too many people concentrated in one place or activities that are deleterious, I guess something's better than nothing, you know. Even on a cruise ship, you know, damn their hides, I like to think that some people will see some pelagic birds and so on. A lot of what passes for getting away to nature these days is actually what, yes, people might call ecotourism or even eco-porn, and not to mention the extreme sports of, you know, mountain biking in a way that really does damage the landscape and certainly other people's experience, let alone the motorbikes up in the wilderness and so on. But even a lot of the nature trips that people take, so-called, connect in a sort of a shallow way. Sort of ticking off the birds, maybe, or ticking off the national parks. Imagine what a difference it could make if the people make it a connection of some depth instead. I like to think of it in terms of pelicans. Here at the mouth of the Columbia, we're visited by two species of pelicans, white pelicans and brown pelicans, and they fish in very different ways. You know, they have the big gaping bills, but they fill them differently. White pelicans sort of cruise on the water and sieve the water and dive from the surface with their big bills, and they come up with this like a seine net that then they squeeze the water out and they get the fish. Brown pelicans, on the other hand, fish in a very different, very exciting way. They cruise over the water, and like a tern, they slam down into the surface of the water, and they catch the fish that way, as a tern would do, or a kingfisher. So I like to think of the nature cruisers as the white pelicans. They're just skimming the surface. But the naturalists, and that can be anyone, doesn't take special training. It just takes an intent to really connect. And that involves slamming in there gently, but with depth, with commitment, with intent to come back with something good. And not really knowing what it's going to be. We want to be surprised. Now, when you can be surprised, and when you can achieve some intimacy with the natural history around you, that's just as important as seeing new species or making great discoveries. And children are very, very good at that. I think it's that kind of intimacy with nature that we need just as much as time out there in order to defeat the extinction of experience and the nature deficit disorder. It's quality as well as the quantity of time we spend outdoors. And it doesn't necessarily take a huge amount of study and knowing the name of every species, but it takes paying attention.
One of the things that I think concerns a lot of people of our age who are old enough to remember places before they were, quote, discovered, and Beetle Rock is one of them. You referred to a book that was written about Beetle Rock a long time ago. And I think about lots of places. I think about most of the wildlands around Portland, particularly the Columbia Gorge, which is just inundated with people now. And in the spring of 2017, I hiked up Eagle Creek, which I used to go to every year. And it was just, there were so many people, and there's people wearing bathing suits and bikinis and walking in flip-flops and doing things they shouldn't be doing in the woods. And
like throwing firecrackers over the edge?
We will get to there. So there was more I had to do with human excrement, actually. And I decided that I wasn't going to go there again. I just could not handle it. And it was really painful because I've been going there for, you know, almost 50 years. So then the fire happened a few months later, and no, nobody goes to Eagle Creek anymore. And part of me felt like that fire needed to happen, even though it was done as an example of people who shouldn't be there. There were two things that I wondered about, and one is, should we, actually you mentioned this, I'm just remembering that. You talk about getting a license so you can go in the woods. Do we need to train people so that they can actually know how to be in the woods? And how do we also maybe limit who goes into the woods unless they're people who respect it and want to have the intimate experience you're describing?
That's a tough one. We could go into a lot of places, but you're quite right. The essay that you referred to in Nature Matrix is called A Different Day on Beetle Rock. Now, I was referring to a great old book from the 40s by Sally Carragher called A Day on Beetle Rock. Beetle Rock is one of the granite domes in Sequoia National Park, where I was a ranger in 1969, over a half century ago. And I was so excited to go see Beetle Rock, and when I got there, I found it full of broken glass and litter and noisy people misbehaving and ruining the sunset, you know, such as you described for Eagle Creek. And this is a long time ago. And I wrote this essay in response to my experience as a ranger, that people should be required to learn something about the purposes of national parks and how their behavior is expected. Take a simple test and get a parks pass, just the way they would do as a driver's license. Some people probably found that essay proto-fascist, you know, because I was imposing a prescription for behavior upon visitors to the public lands. But I wondered, do I want to include that in this collection all these years later? And I found that I still stand by it. Obviously, one has to make it accessible to a great range of people and not make it like a poll tax or something to go to the national park. But what are we doing instead? We're raising the daily entry fee to national parks to where it does become truly elitist. Instead, we should keep it cheap, subsidize it, which is a very small bit of the budget, and yet inculcate people into the values and how to love a national park and how to behave with it. But let me go to your Eagle Creek experience. Your thought that perhaps the fire was due at Eagle Creek to clean things up brings to mind one of my favorite poems, a really tough poem, Tough on Us, by Robinson Jeffers. whom some thought to be a misanthrope. But he wrote a poem called November Surf, about when the big wave comes and washes off all the former insults. He talked about all the used condoms left on the rocks. This is in the 30s, you know, the rocks around Carmel and the human excrement and just the big mess and so on. But one day in November would come the big wave that would wash things clean again. And then he talked about how the land envied the shore, its wave. So I went on from that in a poem that appears on a record album that I recorded with Chris Novoselic called Butterfly Launches from Sparpole, Chris's music and my poems. And we did one called The Big Wave. You can find it on YouTube. We did a video of it. And I take Robinson Jeffers' idea and I take it a little bit farther about the land envying the big wave. Sometime the big wave is gonna come and it's really gonna clean things up. Okay, is that misanthropic? Well, perhaps to some degree, but in fact, we know that wave's coming. The tsunami's gonna be here, and we're looking at, from this porch, will not look the same 20 minutes later. We know this, it will happen. Do I take a perverse pleasure in that? Certainly not, for the people or the architecture or the things I love here. But do I take a certain amount of sense of deferred justice for the enormities that we've inflicted on the rest of nature with the payback that's coming? I guess I have to say I do. Not in a way that I'm wishing ill toward anyone, but in a way that I'm saying, as many people have, if we don't clean up our act, there's going to be hell to pay in many, many ways.
There's another side to this too, which you also talk about, which is the way that a lot of, well, national parks in particular and other natural areas that are in cities or near cities are manicured and the wildness is taken out of them. Why do you think that happens and how could that be also altered?
I think it happens because of people's desire for control to manicure their setting in such a way that makes them comfortable and to feel unthreatened in a way that's pretty, but unthreatening. This is universal. It goes way back to Capability Brown and the architecture in Britain that followed the medieval formal gardens to create the kind of pastoral gardens and rustic gardens with follies and so on that gave the impression of wildness. But it was a particularly unthreatening wildness that fit into all the perks and privileges and comforts of privilege, of wealth. And we still try to do that on a little bit more proletarian way in our parks and our refuges. This is why when we set land aside for any purposes of nature conservation and encounter with it, we have to be very, very careful to make sure the managers don't pervert those purposes. Now, I have been glad to see, going back to Sequoia National Park, to a reunion of rangers a few years ago, that the Park Service kind of got it. And Beetle Rock is very, very different now. It's closer to the one that Sally Carragher knew because they drastically reduced the footprint of people in the giant forest village. Mind you, that's had a side effect of making things more expensive for people to find lodging, and it's less democratic, but it's also more protected. We exist within the parameters of these trade-offs, which are not always palatable.
Well, I wanted to talk about this place that's really magical to you, the landscape between Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams, and that goes north. And that's an area that hasn't become a national park. So what makes it so attractive to you, and what do you think needs to happen to protect it without it turning into Rainier National Park?
We're talking about the area called the Dark Divide Roadless Area. Let me preface it by saying that where I live, across the river from here, in the Willapa Hills of Washington, has no federal land whatever, except a couple of wildlife refuges on the waters. But up in those hills, there's no national forest, there's no national park. It's all a little bit of state land and almost entirely private land. So it's been logged early and logged often. The reason I'm able to easily acquire solitude in the hills where I live is because it's all logged off. There's almost nothing to attract anyone there. And I wrote a book called Wintergreen about my love for damaged lands, lands that have been hurt. We can't throw them away. We got to still love them and make of them what we can. So we protected the last little bits of old growth up there. And we try to work on a kind of logging that will continue to provide fiber and livelihood to the local people, but also provide some opportunity for small-scale wildness and other species. But it's never going to be overrun by hikers and campers and so on, and RVs, because it's frankly pretty beat up. Now, let's move east of there, across I-5, and into the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. Up and down the Cascades, there is a panoply of protected areas, from Mount Baker National Recreation Area in the North Cascades National Park in the north, all the way down to Mount Lassen National Park in the south. Mount Shasta, Mount Jefferson, the Three Fingers, the Bachelor, the Sisters, Hood, and St. Helens. I should be giving them all their Native American names, Lou Witt and Patois and Y East and so on. They're all protected in their own way. And frankly, St. Helens was the last major Cascade volcano to get protected. That's why it blew up, I'm convinced. It was owned by a logging company on the tip top of St. Helens. It was getting logged all around it. She said, the hell with that, and blew her top, and now it's Mount St. Helens National Volcanic Monument. But in between Lou Witt on the west, Mount St. Helens, and Pateau on the east, Mount Adams, which are protected as wildlands now, there is an extensive area that is roadless but unprotected except by the Clinton Forest Plan that could be changed by anybody else's signature overnight and logged and roaded because it has no formal protection. It's called the Dark Divide, and it was left out of all the Washington wilderness bills. The Forest Service used to have a different name for it because of its shape from all the logging roads coming in from the sides. They made it look like an amoeba, and the formal name of it was the Amoeba Roadless Area. Nobody's ever gonna set aside a wilderness area called amoeba, and so fortunately the other name was available. It was the local name that people called the watershed divide between the Cispus River and the Lewis River. They called it the Dark Divide. And through that area runs the Boundary Trail number 1, the old Indian trading highway, and the oldest trail in the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. It's an area of great mystique, great beauty, black rock ridge of shaggy, snaggy rocks that runs perpendicular to the axis of the Cascades from St. Helens on the west to Adams on the east. And the conservation community, the roadless area people, decided, let's change the name from amoeba and call this area the Dark Divide. Then it might have a chance as wilderness. So that's the name that it came to have. Now, a number of years ago, I had the extraordinary opportunity through the even weirder fact that I had a Guggenheim Fellowship to study Bigfoot. Now, that's the weirdest thing that ever happened. Bigfoot walked up here on this porch right now, Barbara, and sat in your lap and started feeding you bonbons. That would not be as strange as me getting a Guggenheim Fellowship to study Bigfoot. Now, would it? You know, be honest. But I did, and it was because I think of two things. One was I wasn't trying to find Bigfoot or prove Bigfoot or disprove Bigfoot. I was looking into the power and the consequence of the Bigfoot stories, myths, and legends, and possible reality that has run all through Native American tradition in the Northwest for a very, very long time, longer than we can know, and certainly through white culture since at least the late 18th century. Become quite a thing these days, although one question is, has it become just a tabloid joke, or does Bigfoot today maintain any of the power and dignity and consequence of the Native American stories? That was the thrust of my studies. But I think the real reason I got both the fellowship and the book contract, and ultimately the movie that's been made from it that's showing now, was because of that cool name, The Dark Divide. I mean, what a gift. The Dark Divide could be the divide between belief and non-belief, between spirituality and a purely physical view of the world, between sanity and the other side. It could be the dividing line between that which we hope for and that which we know. Any number of divides could be the Dark Divide. The Dark Divide really came from a prospector named John Dark, who was a pioneer, and his name became attached to Dark Meadow, Dark Mountain, Dark This, Dark That, and ultimately the Dark Divide. So it's a quirk of history, but it gave me this wonderful, wonderful name to work with.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Robert Michael Pyle, Northwest environmental writer, poet, novelist, and butterfly expert. And now we're talking about the dark divide.
You asked me why it's special, why it's important, and what must be done about it to protect it without ruining it like an overloved place. And I would say very concisely that A, it's special because it's the largest unprotected roadless area in Washington, one of the biggest in the West. That should be enough. But also it has a great depth of character and of wildness and of lore. Well, all that Bigfoot lore, the reason I went there in my studies was because it is steeped in the lore of Sasquatch, of Tsleil-Waututh, of Tsleil-Waututh and Oma, the Kwikitat people and the Yakima people and other groups. Actually abandoned parts of the Dark Divide because of what they considered in the 20th century the abundance of Bigfoot. And you can't talk to a person who knows that land, the Indian berry fields and so on, who doesn't believe that the animal exists there. In reality, not as a spirit creature like Tsetseudl, a sea serpent, or thunderbird, but like skunk and weasel and bear and mink and butterfly, a real member of the fauna. So it's special for those reasons, but it's also special because it hasn't been protected. So how can it be protected and yet retain its wildness? Only, I think, by being added to the National Wilderness System, which is, of course, under attack, but it hasn't been abolished yet by the malign powers that for a short time yet still be. But it hasn't been able to be protected. What we need for that to happen is not only a Democratic Congress, or let's say a Congress that supports wilderness, not only a president who supports wilderness, but also a third district congressperson who supports wilderness. But I would like to say vote, and please vote for the person who you think embodies your values. And one of the values I hope you'll look for is conservation, the good old word of conservation. And I think that if we're able to have a Congress, including the local district, that embraces wilderness and human values as expressed in wildness, then we've got a chance to protect the Dark Divide in the long run.
So let's wind up by talking a bit more about Nature Matrix and what that name means and what the whole gist, what are you trying to get across in this book?
I've been very, very lucky with names of books. You know, my novel that we talked about on the radio, Magdalena Mountain, what a lovely name. I've been gifted with some wonderful names of books. Dark Divide, I mean, that's now a movie, you know. People go to darkdividefilm.com. They'll be able to say the movie made from the book Where Bigfoot Walks. And again, that's all because of the name. So names matter. Names matter. And for this book, which is a collection of new and selected essays, that's not going to draw anybody in. New and selected essays by Bob Pyle. You know, that's going to be a snooze. But if there's a name that can intrigue people, maybe they'll open the cover and take a look. And so I went back to a name that occurred to me 50 years ago when I was trying to throw together a book of my earliest essays when I was in college back at the UW, 1970. I was supposed to be working on my master's thesis. Instead, I put together a book manuscript, and I'm thinking, what can I call it? Well, I was studying geology, and I understood the name matrix to mean everything that's connected and how they're connected and the background that brings all parts together. That's a matrix. Cool. And I was a naturalist, so wow, we could have Nature Matrix. And I wrote that book 50 years ago. It was a bad book. I'm really glad it wasn't published. But a couple of the pieces in that original manuscript made it 50 years forward into the current book. And along with it came the idea of Nature Matrix, which is the title essay. And that idea has become a very hard-hitting piece, I believe, that I was asked to write for the 100th anniversary edition of a journal called Oryx, the International Environmental Magazine. They wanted my thoughts as a, you know, who am I? What do I have to say? What do I know? But I'd written a lot of books about humans and nature, humans and the rest of nature. So what did I think was necessary in the next 100 years? So I wrote this essay called Nature Matrix. I've updated it for the book. And what it is a clarion call for a degree of radical thinking toward humans and the land that goes way beyond contemporary economics. It goes beyond the Marxian dialectic. It goes beyond certainly some joke comparison of liberal and conservative as if that had any substance to the debate. When I try to think about what I mean by nature matrix and what I think we actually need to go forward as a species, I think, oh, wait a minute, right off the porch here, right off the porch as we sit here right now, I see there's a flock of 50 or 75 white pelicans flying past, the very white pelicans I was speaking about a little while earlier. What a grand sight that is. What a sight. White pelicans flying beneath a cirrus cloud in a blue sky. Well, I've made it through. We've made it through. We get to see that. We still got a little time left. But what about our kids? What about our grandkids? What about generations into the future? Are they still going to be able to see such a sight as that? And hear scrub jays in the background? Maybe. But I'm not so optimistic unless some really, really radical changes are made. And when I say radical, I mean an entire different economics. One that, of course, will include trade, because that's what humans do. They trade goods and services. But where the goodness of life and the goodness of culture and systems is not measured by trade, is not measured by a GNP, is not measured by growth, certainly, because permanent growth, which any economic system as it stands today is based upon, whether it's Marxist or capitalist, it's all based on growth. And we cannot have permanent growth in any species and expect it to survive, because the other name for that is cancer. And that's not a new idea with me. But what I have tried to make fresh in this book is a list of things that need to occur in terms of social reform for us to have any chance at all. And primary among that list is a land ethic based on the one that was articulated by Aldo Leopold in the 1940s. And it essentially says, a thing is good when it perpetuates that which is beautiful, that which is diverse, that which is self-sustaining. And it's bad when it doesn't. That's very hard to accomplish. It certainly isn't going to be accomplished by carbon credits or by a meeting in Rio that comes out with a set of plans. Well, I've laid out my plan for what I think has to happen, but I haven't laid out a mechanism for making it happen. Because as far as I can see so far, the only two means available for that, one of them is magical thinking, which is not available, and the other one is a form of maximum power, which becomes fascism. That's not available either, thank God. There has to be a third way. There has to be a way by ultimate consensus of people operating through self-consent to make changes of a dimension that we have barely even imagined. And I try to give my idea of what those changes would need to be. And then I happily admit at the end of it that so far it's a fairy tale. But it's a fairy tale that we have to find a way into. Or I'm sure that nature will persist. I'm optimistic in our own short term just because that's my nature. But the midterm, where human life will continue, will not be a happy place unless the kind of change I put forth in Nature Matrix can actually be brought about.
Well, Robert, it's really great to talk to you, and I'm so glad we're doing this in person. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Oh, Barbara, thanks for having me. I may be just making a muddle of things, as I probably always do, but I have fun doing it, because there's no point in doing any of this if we're not having some fun. Germ or not, coming tsunami or not, I mean, look, we're surrounded by great beauty, and we can continue to do that if we can only keep on loving it.
We've been talking with Robert Michael Pyle, author of Nature Matrix, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Robert Michael Pyle. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
When the autumn tides arrive each year, big waves come ashore and wash the beach like a giant sponge. Come winter, the storms hit harder yet and scrape the shoreline clean. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes, the valleys beyond and the hills above are jealous of that seaside purging. They abide and imagine such a bath as would scour the cumbered continent free of its dirty old blot. When the big wave comes, when the big wave comes. But when the plates finally slip, as plates will do, and the big wave comes ashore, all insults will be washed away and the land again come clean. When the big wave comes, when that big old mama wave comes, when that big wave comes on down, and after that wave, as Robinson Jeffers wrote, the humans will be fewer, the hawks more common, the rivers pure from mouth to source. And we'll know again at last what it's like to live on a coast made fresh once more. When the big wave comes. When the big wave comes. When the big wave.